now you've missed your chance. Hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LaPage.
Vince Masson.
And this is the first time we've had the two of you together in studio, and so I'm hoping that this is like the rivalry, that, you know, we're going to get some good friction here, because CFRU brings too many people together in friendship, I find, is what
Wait,
I'm getting
we need
at.
More controversy.
Exactly right. I'm glad Candace is on the same page. We'll see how you do, Vince.
Well, I was hoping that the red carpet would be rolled out outside this studio, but apparently you were going in a different direction. Yeah.
Special treatment. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies. But this week we are changing things up slightly, because we can now say it is officially the Christmas season. It is upon us, and we thought, what a more perfect time to talk about Christmas movies. So we've prepared a list of five each, and we will go through them in no particular order, because order is for professional radio people. Am I right?
Yes, and also because I don't think checking a list twice is really relevant around this time of the year, so I just have my list, that's it.
Well, Vince, since you have all your jokes together, why don't you kick things off?
Okay, well, to preface, let me just say this, okay? The usual, maybe traditional Christmas movies that, you know, surface on everybody's best of list, I tried to go in a different direction, so not a lot of those movies will be on my list. I tried to pick movies that still revolve around Christmas in some way, shape, or form, but are not necessarily Christmas movies, quote unquote. So at number five, I actually have Curtis Hanson's masterpiece, L.A. Confidential, which, again, takes place. You're laughing. It takes place during Christmas. And I would argue that there is no better Christmas movie imagery than Russell Crowe beating a man with a giant candy cane. So if that does not qualify under the Christmas movie
Just like
banner.
Joseph in the original Bible story when he couldn't find a room.
Yeah, that was... Oh, you took the words right out of my mouth, man. That's what I was segueing into.
I guess I've been a while since I've seen L.A. Confidential,
yeah.
And I didn't know it took place at Christmas.
Yeah,
so I've forgotten.
It's again, one of my... it's one of the sneaky things maybe I'll do with this segment. things that, again, not Christmas movies, but movies that feature Christmas in some capacity.
Okay, well, how about this? Is there an overtly Christmassy scene that you can mention?
Actually, the movie opens with like a news article, and it's like the Christmas Massacre, which was a real thing, by the way. It was a real thing where the LA cops, like, I don't know, beat a bunch of prisoners in the 50s.
This
so
really is
actually,
going
I could argue
directions.
The first scene of the film is pertaining to Christmas.
All right, Candace, try and top Christmas Massacre.
All right, then. Well, so... most of them on my list are fairly traditional, with potentially a few that, you know, are a little from the outside. However, this one that I'm going to talk about first, because I came up with four pretty solid, you know, movies that I think of as Christmas related that I watch at Christmas. And then I had a couple of other ones that I was like, well, you know, sometimes I watch this. That one's pretty good, but it never really seems to be high on my list.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, I went with Star Trek's 1 through 5.
What?
So,
and you thought my pick was unorthodox. There you go.
So here's the deal. I come from a long line of Star Trek fans. We're Trekkies. Thank you very much.
So let's see where this is going.
So those of you who have the Space Channel know that every single Christmas day, starting at 6 a.m., you can start watching Star Trek, The Motionless Picture. And then usually by about 8, when we tend to get up, you can start watching The Wrath of Khan, and then The Search for Spock, and then The Voyage Home, and it goes on and on, usually stopping at number 6, The Undiscovered Country. And the TV is pretty much on, so my entire family gets together, my entire extended family gets together at the old family abode. We live, sleep, eat, breathe, all in the same 3-bedroom house for a few days. So the television is on come 6 a.m. on Christmas Day, and the Star Trek movies. I guess that's Star Trek 1 through 6. Mm-hmm. I kind of forget about Star Trek 5 and Star Trek 1. You know, neither of them is high on our list, but 2, 3, 4, and 6.
Okay. I thought there was a Star Trek movie that I had missed, like where William Shatner like throws like a Christmas party on the ship or something. But no, it's just...
Yeah, it's just this particular... So this is the thing, right? Like a holiday movie is a movie that you watch with your family at the holidays, right? To like, you know...
Okay.
So something you associate with Christmas just as much as... Right. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
All right. So we have one postmodern film noir. We have... 6 movies about a spaceship crew, none of which contain Christmas. Although, interestingly, there is a sequence in Generations where Picard has an imaginary Christmas with his imaginary family in the Nexus. So, missed that one, Trekkie.
Sorry. I'm TOS all the way.
So yours is obviously going to be Space Jam just to round out the Christmas, you know, theme.
Because Michael
here.
Jordan was a gift to mankind.
Hey, yeah.
Not unlike Jesus, which is actually the topic of, because I kind of went strangely traditional with my list.
So they're about Christmas. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So my first one is The Nativity Story, which is a 2006 film from Catherine Hardwicke, which is basically The Nativity Story. It is Mary and Joseph. It was Keisha Castle Hughes, who played Mary, an early Oscar Isaac appearance as Joseph.
Really?
Yeah, and it's very straightforward. It is a very Sunday school adaptation. Like, there's no weird, you know, like Joseph has a alternate personality or something or anything weird like that. It's a very straightforward adaptation of that traditional Christmas story. And you know, I kind of admired that about it. It's beautiful scenery. It's like really well acted. I liked Oscar Isaac and. The basic goodness of Joseph in it, and you know, the core message. And I think A.O. Scott put it well when he said, you know, it shows why, you know, in the Bible Jesus becomes a good man. It's not because he's the son of God, it's because his, you know, adopted father was also a good, decent man. And this kind of shows why Joseph is kind of a side character in the Bible. So there was a lot of room, let's say, for Oscar Isaac to do his Oscar Isaac thing and just be a very charming, personable actor. And yeah, it's you know, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I found the movie very, very rewarding in terms of being, you know, a straightforward nativity story, a traditional Christmas story. So that's my number 5.
All right. Wow.
I don't know, that's feeling a little out of place, honestly, Adam. Just, like, it's nativity. I don't see how it fits in. Yeah.
I don't know what show you're on.
I don't know what show I'm on either. This is not going how I envisioned. Okay. All right, Vince, you're number 4.
Okay, well, to continue with the tradition of, you know, movies centered around Christmas, I'm actually going with Tim Burton's Batman Returns. And if you're going to tell me you don't remember where Christmas fits into that movie, then I'm sorry, I can't like do anything for you.
But. No, I remember perfectly. I actually almost included that on my list, actually.
Oh, see, there you go. We're working towards like a mutual.
We're getting there.
Exactly.
There is common ground. There is an overlap in the Venn diagram.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would actually say this is my favorite Batman, like excluding the Christopher Nolan ones. I feel like I should always throw that in there. But I remember this movie like really disturbing me as a child. It does kind of have some disturbing imagery, not the least of which is Danny DeVito dressed up as a penguin.
Yeah. And not the least of which is the inference that if he's not a full-on child molester, then he's definitely a child killer.
Yeah, exactly. Which,
another great Christmas message. but no, that's a good one because I like that movie. I like the design of it a lot. It is one of my favorite Batman movies, even though I come from a comic book geeky background. Mm-hmm. And I understand why comic book fans hate it, but just from pure cinema, it is, and just pure like Tim Burton zaniness. It is so awesome. It is so lavish in its attention to detail. And the circus gang is, like, every single one of them is awesome. I wish there was, like, a circus. Like, I guess today there would probably be, like, a circus gang spinoff in the works, and I almost wish that happened.
Yeah, but... 4-part series.
On Netflix or something. Yeah, so that's a good choice. I will give you that.
Okay, well, thank you. We're moving closer to the Christmas theme that we originally started out with.
Candace, what random thing do you have for us?
All right. Well, so the rest of mine are pretty typically a little bit more, you know, Christmas related. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to choose Gremlins for this one.
Oh,
just
okay.
To get the last sort of, you know, the controversial one. Is it a Christmas movie or is it not? I think that there is absolutely no question. Obviously, it is a Christmas movie.
Mm.
Not only does it take place at Christmas, the entire, you know, Christmas is the catalyst of the whole story, right? He brings home a gift, though I guess it's technically not quite Christmas. It's like just early, but it's...
Well, you can't leave a live animal under the tree for weeks.
It's true. Most, you know, much of the score is Christmas music. It's very, very Christmassy. And despite the horror of it, there is also some good messages.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
like
not
what
sure
you were
what
saying,
they are
don't
right
leave
now.
An animal under the tree.
Yeah.
That seems
keep
as good
trying
as
no matter how hard you fail at inventing things.
Mm-hmm. also, you know, method acting when it comes to role-playing Santa, not recommended.
yeah, that's definitely a lesson I did learn. Right, the chimney is not
chimneys
actually
are
for
not
going
meant
down.
To go down, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because we had Chris Jagola of the Guelph Concert Band. We did an interview with him. I should say I did an interview with him, the Royal We. But the Gremlins rag was, or I guess it was a medley of various themes from Gremlins, was included mm-hmm. in that Guelph Concert Band Christmas show, which is an unusual choice. I don't disagree that Gremlins is a Christmas movie, but the theme itself, the Gremlins rag, they use it again in Gremlins 2, which does not take place at Christmas.
No, but it is the height of consumerism, Gremlins 2.
That's true.
So
that's the backdoor message. That's how they Die Hard 2'd that.
Yeah.
That's that
Are
Joe
you
Dante
that term now.
Yeah.
I am. Okay. That's Joe Dante working on so many levels. That's one of the things I, you know, Joe Dante doesn't work enough anymore.
He really doesn't. He's yeah, and nor does Christopher Columbus.
True.
Chris Columbus was the
he
wrote
Gremlins.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's very true. But you know, Chris Columbus, I think, is a very good journeyman director. But you know, Dante actually has some ideas. There is an auteur quality to Joe Dante. If you watch his Twilight Zone segment, that has Joe Dante written all over it.
Which one is it?
It's like the. It's kind of loosely based on about three different Twilight Zone stories, and it's a kid with superpowers plus like getting sucked into a TV plus, you know, it's like the one thing that's kind of completely, it's the one Twilight Zone segment that almost feels completely out of place.
Like it's more like an Outer Limits?
Speaking
of rabbit holes.
Three people just got that joke and they are laughing. Yeah, it's, but you know, he's got a voice and he's got a lot of talent, and it's sad that, you know, there's his two most recent, I think, are on Netflix right now, which is The Hole, which I saw.
That was a great film. I really enjoyed that.
And it was used 3D in a great way. It was the first time I saw a 3D movie, actually, because I saw it at Toronto International Film Festival, and somebody pulled the fire alarm, so I missed the last 20 minutes for years waiting for it to come to a theater, and I never did, and I watched it on Netflix. And then, Dad, I can't remember. Burying Your Ex is the other one.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, so that's funny. It's Life After Beth, but directed by Joe Dante. It's interesting. So I'm going to follow Vincent Burton theme because I chose Edward Scissorhands as another one. That's one that takes place at Christmas. The major portion of the final act is Christmas time. And, of course, it's kind of implied that the bookend, the grandma and the granddaughter, is kind of a Christmas time because it's snowing outside. And, of course, you find out at the end, spoiler alert for Edward Scissorhands, it's because Edward is up in his mansion on the hill making ice sculptures at around every Christmas time of the young Kim, and that's why it snows in this very clearly Florida or California style suburb at Christmas time, is because Edward Scissorhands is letting it fly with the snow sculptures. But yeah, the Christmas, and I guess one of the things I noted from it is, I mean, obviously a large portion of the film is about alienation and feeling out of place, and you know, some people feel that way at Christmas time. Maybe they don't have a family. Maybe
they have scissors on their hands.
Maybe they have scissors on their hands.
You know, you never know what happens.
Maybe, maybe they, you know, their elaborate artisanal bush cutting business is down for the season. And you know,
that's a bit of a stretch. I don't know.
Coming from LA Confidential, it's a bit of a stretch. Okay, but no, it's I guess there's a connection there, you know, because people do feel especially alienated at Christmas time. Maybe they're not connected with their families. Maybe they don't feel they fit in with their families. But you know, this is the time of year where that, you know, comes into sharp relief, and you know, you have to kind of deal with that. And I think there are times in our lives where we all feel like a scissor hands, whether we have scissors for hands or not.
And well said.
Thank you. But yeah, it's because also the climax takes place at Christmas, and Edward, you know, killed a guy in Christmas. So there you go.
Another spoiler.
There's another spoiler.
Yeah.
Another.
Yeah. It's a lot of death at Christmas in these movies we've chosen.
Sorry. Yeah, we're kind of morbid people.
They're probably going to do an origin story of Edward Scissorhands anyway. So
I think they're going to do an origin story for this show, this episode of this show. Like, what's wrong with these people? And how many murders did they witness? Speaking of murders, Vince, what's your next pick?
Okay, is that how we're segueing? Because you know what? You might be right.
So. Oh, good.
Okay.
Outstanding.
No. So my number three, once again, is slightly out of the box. It is Stanley Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut, which again takes place around Christmas and might be a detail that has been overlooked by whoever actually saw the film.
Okay, I'm just going to play a clip right here.
Yes, please.
Bill, I know what happened last night. And I know what's been going on since then. And I think you just might have the wrong idea about one or two things. Okay, he had a bruise on his face. That's a hell of a lot less than he deserves.
I will note that there is Christmas wreaths in the background of that scene.
There you go, yes.
Sidney Pollack has decorated his lavish mansion with Christmas decorations while he chastises Tom Cruise for being at an invite-only orgy.
And I believe that was like 50, 60 takes or something that they did of that scene. Just them talking. There was absolutely no like real reason that I
think there
see
was about 50
in.
Or 60 takes of Tom Cruise staring incredulously at Sidney Pollack. There was easily 500 takes on that scene alone. But go ahead.
Well, if you're going to call it Eyes Wide Shut, you need some affiliation with, you know, Tom Cruise's eyes.
I suppose.
Anyway, so Christmas doesn't play, you know, a significant thematic role in the movie, but it's, you know, there are wreaths kind of around the city, and there is the light snowfall in New York and whatnot.
I think you mean London, but go ahead.
Touche. So, yeah, I feel like a lot of people have not seen. This is like a part of maybe, you know, one of those Stanley Kubrick movies that people don't talk about too much. Mm-hmm. So definitely check it out if you're looking for a Stanley Kubrick / Christmas movie.
Could you imagine an actual Stanley Kubrick Christmas movie?
Yeah, that came out really ineffectively, I would say. If you're looking for a Stanley Kubrick movie that you haven't seen.
His Napoleon had an elaborate Christmas sequence, didn't you know? He was going to make Napoleon and was going to have an elaborate Christmas scene with the Napoleon Christmas, you know? Okay. Napoleon Christmas.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
You know, it's interesting about Eyes Wide Shut. It's hard to sort of watch it on its own. Not that I've tried lately, but
without since... considering the rest of his filmography, you mean?
Kubrick, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say about without considering Tom Cruise and Scientology because.
Oh, okay.
Was it Gibney who made that movie?
Don't look at me. I have never seen that movie.
Going
because
clear?
That's past my Tom
it was
Cruise
Gibney, yeah.
boycott.
Okay, but you haven't seen Going Clear though.
I don't think so.
The Gibney documentary about Scientology. Okay, because he uses when he's talking about the Kidman Cruise breakup, he uses footage from Eyes Wide Shut. To sort of illustrate that and why Scientology may have been, you know,
related to their
breakup or renewed dedication to Scientology was related to their breakup. And so now that's now there's like an extra layer of like real life context on top of that. But that's neither here nor there and not related to Christmas. So Candace, bring us back to Earth.
All right. So... I mean, this feels a little awkward after the last movie, but it's a Charlie Brown Christmas. Which, you know, and it's sort of funny because...
Really totally very similar, I would say. I don't know what you mean.
Yeah. Those long sequences of Charlie Brown walking around town.
It's true. It is a little... There is a lot of empty space in It's a Charlie Brown Christmas for like a... Well, how long is it? 18 minutes long or something?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of mise-en-scene in Charlie Brown's Christmas.
Yes, yes. And it is sort of funny because as we talk about some of these movies that are just sort of set at Christmas that don't really... aren't necessarily Christmas... films. This one, obviously, it's about Christmas in many, many different ways, and yet the Vince Guaraldi's soundtrack is played year-round, right? Like, except for potentially O Tannenbaum. I feel like anything else on the soundtrack is...
It's hard to get away with that in July, right?
at the
summer barbecue.
But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those. There are only a few movies sort of on my... It doesn't feel like the holidays until I watch this film. And It's a Charlie Brown Christmas tends to be the first one that I want to, you know... And I think because the soundtrack is so good and you can kind of get away with it, like, in October...
Yeah,
you can start watching this film pretty early.
You know, and the thing about that special is, I'm trying to think of what I'm trying to say here, but I think that colors sort of all of Peanuts. Sort of when you think about the comic strip, or when you think of any of the other cartoons, even the Peanuts movie that came out a couple of years ago, which I liked a lot. You know, a big portion of it is sort of the Christmas. It's not like the Christmas special redone, but you can hear those notes, and it's the music, and it's the Charlie Brownness of it, and that particular voice. I think that special colors any interaction you have with Peanuts on any level, whether you just know. I think people know that special even better than they know the strips.
Yeah, certainly, and I think probably the characterization of any of the characters, they would just go with whatever it is in the movie first before looking to something else.
Yeah, and you know, you hear the, when you read the strip and you see those characters, you hear that, those voices, I guess that was, what,
65.
So, I was going to say 50 years ago, so it was 52 years ago, so.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, and it's still, you know, it's still on TV, I think they play it once a year, and a couple different places do, so yeah, it's... that's a sane, sensible choice, and I'm surprised it came from this panel.
Thank you. I tried really hard with that one.
I also want to capitalize on that, and for my third pick, the original Miracle on 34th Street.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Which I like a lot. I enjoy, I guess, because my other show is political. I'll work that in too. That I enjoy the political overtones of it too. There's the behind the scenes with the judge who's. When Kris Kringle goes on trial, and I guess the judge has ambitions for higher office because he has some sort of political appointee who it is advising him. It's like, dude, you can't put Santa in jail. It's going to be bad for the election. Of course, they elect judges, too, in the state, so that could be a thing. But, I like that. It's kind of like West Wing meets Night Court, but less zany while being at Christmas time. I like that. But I also like the romantic relationship between... I always forget the lawyer's name. But Doris, who was played by Maureen O'Hara, whose daughter is played by the young Natalie Wood. Mm-hmm. and how she's like this kind of it's funny to look back and now that divorce, the idea of divorce was this like huge kind of thing. I was reading up on the movie, and apparently like the Catholic League, or the equivalent of the Catholic League in the late 1940s, was like, well, this movie shows a woman working after a divorce. She's a single mother. And so, you know, there's that. I mean, it doesn't cast her as like a harlot or anything like that. It's just matter of fact. And I imagine that's something that was taking some getting used to in this social strata of Western countries at the time. You know, single mothers, single women, divorcees in the workplace. And, you know, it's also, I also enjoy the good old-fashioned interstore rivalry, the Macy's-Gimbel's rivalry, which Santa, Kris Kringle, negotiates a truce in that, which is also hilarious. And just, you know, Edmund Gwynn, who won an Oscar for it, is so great. He is so natural. It doesn't feel like an act. He doesn't feel like he's playing Santa. He really kind of...
No method acting Santa there.
Yeah, well, you know, he looks the part, and I'm not sure if he, if, you know, I think I've seen pictures of him with a beard, but it isn't like the obvious, like, Santa beard.
Right.
But, so, you know, but he's very natural, and I think Santa's one of those parts that's hard to play off. You got to sort of play it cool, but, you know, be jolly. It's
be in charge.
You gotta find a nice gray
area. Have like a management style, but at the same time you can't be the boss,
right?
And so he hit the sweet spot, and you know, there's just so much joy in the way he talks, even in scenes where he's like upset. You know, it's not so much like he's mad or sad, he's like disappointed. He's kind of like your grandpa. It's It's great, and I love the ending where the little girl Susan asks Santa for a house. Mm-hmm. For her and her mom, and then they drive, and you know, it's the spoilers for Miracle on 34th Street, but you know, but Kris Kringle says, well, you know what, here, take this route home, and she thinks that Santa didn't get her house, but they drive past the house, and they're like, no, this couldn't possibly, and then they see Santa's cane in the corner, it's like, did he? Mm-hmm. But I like that, how that melting, the way they deal with the possibility he could be Santa is like very real, and it's a very bureaucratic resolution. Right? It's like the post office is sending Kris Kringle all the Santa letters, ergo he is Santa, and it ends all neatly together. But there's a little magical touch at the end, and that's how it leaves you with Maureen O'Hara and Natalie Wood and everybody standing there like, was he really Santa? There was never a sequel, so we never find out.
Although there was a subpar remake.
There was there was a couple of remakes. I don't know if it was a TV movie in the 70s, but I think...
Oh, the only one I was familiar with was the...
The 94 one with Richard Attenborough.
Matilda.
With Matilda. Matilda. Whose real name is Mara Wilson.
Okay, sorry.
She has a name.
She is social media famous now.
All right, well...
She's hilarious.
I've been corrected. I'm sorry.
She's funny. Yeah. She's got
decades of calling her Matilda, and now
Matilda's pretty dope, though.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, if you're gonna be known for one thing only,
I love Matilda, but we'll save that for next Christmas.
Why not just make it my number one while we're at it? I might as well just do it.
Well, speaking of number ones, we've got those coming up, our last two, each of our last two items. Before that, though, we are going to take our normal musical break. And you know, here on CFRU, we try to avoid the normal Christmas cliches and playing carols through the holidays, as certain other radio stations do in Guelph. We're not naming any names. But I'm just saying, you could hear them downstairs in Center 6. I'm just saying. So I was looking for something Christmassy, and I found this. And it's a little, what they call in the business, a foreshadow of one of my picks coming up. But it's being sung by none other than Mr. Burl Ives, who, of course, is very famous for being the snowman narrator in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. But he's mixing it up a little folksy here. Maybe it shouldn't be that surprising given his voice, but you know what? Let's just play the tune. This is a tune called Barbara Allen. It is by Burl Ives, and you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
But you slighted Barbara Allen. Oh, yes, I can it well. In the place where I was a-dwelling, I gave a toast to the ladies all, but my love to Barbary Allen. Then lightly tripped she down the stairs. He trembled like an aspen. Tis vain, my dear young man, to hone for Barbary Allen. She walked out in
radio silence until further.
I'm very sorry, Hans. I didn't get that message.
Maybe you should have put it on the bulletin board.
I waxed Tony and Marco and his friend here. I figured you and Carl and Franco might be a little lonely, so I wanted to give you a call.
How does he know so much about this?
This is very kind of you. I assume you are our mysterious party crasher. You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, Hans. Wrong guess.
Would you like to go for double jeopardy where the scores can really change?
These are very bad for you.
Who are you, then?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. The pain in the ass. Whoa.
And that you may recognize as a clip from Die Hard, which was released in 1988 by John McTiernan. That was the director, and that was Bruce Willis there as Mr. McClane. And Alan Rickman is Hans Gruber, and that's my number two pick. So I'm going to start this round since you guys didn't get them didn't get this right. I'm just kidding.
Says the guy who is now going to fight for Die Hard being a Christmas movie. Not that I disagree.
Oh,
but it's controversial.
No. No, I'm glad you mentioned that. Really? You're not going to stake a...
No, I definitely think it's a Christmas movie. I'm staying out of this argument. That's
because I did want to bring that up because there is that debate. Like, is Die Hard a Christmas movie or a movie that takes place at Christmas? Now, I will argue that Die Hard 1 is a Christmas movie. Mm-hmm. Die Hard 2 is a movie that takes place at Christmas, even though they both are action movies involving Christmas. But I think that Christmas is very much part of the Die Hard what it's going for here, because it's a confluence of events. This party at Nakatomi Plaza, this staff party. Obviously, you know, if you are an exceptional thief like Hans Gruber, you are going to choose your target and timing well. And a Christmas party on Christmas Eve seems like a good time to rob a place. And of course, what other possible reason could John and Holly McClane have to sort of reconnect? But at Christmas time, because why else would John go to L.A.? He's clearly not a fan. So it all comes together. Meanwhile, I feel like Die Hard 2 could take place in any airport at any time, mm-hmm. on any remotely busy day. And most airports are busy every day. So that's my argument for why Die Hard is a Christmas movie. I mean, other than that, Die Hard is just a great movie, period. It's got great action, great characterization. And not just like John McClane, and this is before I'm getting into Die Hard 4 and 5, where he's just basically He-Man. You feel every cut, you mm-hmm. feel every hit. He's wandering around barefoot, and even that flubs him up. And you have great characters on the bad guy side, Hans Gruber, obviously. But I mean, all the bad guys kind of have their own personality. One of my favorite scenes in it is when they're getting ready for the police to take the building, the one guy crouches behind the concession stand, and he looks around, and then he starts taking chocolate bars out. That's a great character touch, and it doesn't cost anything, but it gives the movie a bit more personality than just a bunch of rando hench people. And then you have characters like Thornburg, you have Ellis, you have Al Powell. You have the two Agent Johnsons, Big Johnson and Little Johnson, and it's I love Die Hard a lot, and I will stand firm. It is a Christmas movie.
I don't disagree remotly.
Well, why did you pick a fight?
Because I'm just here to make sure everybody sort of sees both sides of the story. The only difference I would say
okay, I didn't know we were on Meet the Press, but okay.
Gremlins, which is also sort of one of those movies, yes, versus Die Hard, is that I feel like Die Hard, I will also watch it at any time of the year.
Sure. Yeah.
Whereas Gremlins, it feels a little weird to watch it at any time of the year outside of Christmas, as far as I'm concerned.
That's an interesting point. But I think Die Hard, I forgot to mention this when I was doing Edward Scissorhands, but somebody got me the Blu-ray for Christmas a couple of years ago, and I watched it like Christmas night, and like the snow was gently falling. And it kind of gave it a little bit of extra resonance. And I feel like that's maybe Die Hard too. Yeah, you can watch it any time of year, but when you're watching it at Christmas and it's Christmas time and you got the decorations up and you know, it's
agreed.
It feels gives it a little extra something.
Yeah.
All right, since you're so smart, Candace, what's your number two?
All right. Gosh, let's see. Weighing the options. So I'm going to go slightly unorthodox. And anybody who listens to the show should probably be ready, have been listening for this film the whole time.
Yes.
Because as I did say, so my favorite horror film of all time also happens to be Canadian. So therefore, it's my favorite Canadian film of all time is Black Christmas by Bob Clark.
Hello? 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 Oh, hell, not again.
Billy!
Billy? I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
What your mother and I must know is, where did you put the baby, Billy?
You've got the wrong number.
Where did you put Agnes, Billy?
Billy.
Look, I'm telling you, you have the wrong number.
What your mother and I must know is, Billy!
Where did Agnes put Billy, Candace?
Well, you know,
we must know.
It's a little left up. I mean, that's one of the beautiful, like the beauty things about this film is that we aren't handheld through it, right? We don't.
Yeah.
We don't really find out as much about the killer, about Billy, as
no,
they say.
That's true.
Yeah, but I would just like to apologize to anybody who's perhaps listening to the show with their headphones on. I'm sorry. That was probably a little creepy in your ears to listen to. But it's one of those things, again, another thing. So many things I think are well done about this film, and the audio is done so well in it,
yes,
too, right? You really feel, you know, like you're Olivia Hussey alone in a big house, or maybe there's only three or four other of her sisters, her sorority sisters, in the house because everybody's leaving for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been getting these creepy calls, and all of those calls are very unsettling when we see them, you know, live on the in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I need that feeling in my life a little bit more because I haven't seen the film, but now you've just enticed me.
Yeah, there's a really great atmosphere to it. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it doesn't spoon feed you like details, like just stuff is just happening. And it's sort of the fact that this is like pre-cell phone and pre-computer, and like, you know, that scene begins with Olivia Hussey like running down the stairs to answer
the phone.
Because I guess it's like a little bit pre-answering machine too. It accentuates that isolation all the more. And that's a great clip. And another clip I almost went with, but there was swearing at the end of it, was when they get another obscene phone call. Mm-hmm. And all the women are there, including Andrea Martin.
Yes.
Very young Andrea Martin. I think it's pre-SCTV days.
Yeah.
And then Margot Kidder is there too. And Margot Kidder is like kind of like the Queen Bee character. But she's like, Olivia Hussey's holding out the phone and they're all listening to him like heavy breathing and using all this like bad like language and all this like really terrible like pseudo eroticism about licking things. And you see Margot Kidder there with like a cigarette and she's like listening. She's like, yeah, okay, this is terrible. It's, there's such great characterization in that. So you know where she's coming from. She's no wallflower, you know that.
It's great. I mean, the women in these, like the characters of the women are all, you know, they're all strong women. Some of them survive. And some of them don't. It is a horror film. That's
I'm
what
sorry.
Happens.
Spoiler alert.
Are you telling me that people in a horror movie die?
Occasionally they do, yes.
What kind
I'm
of Christmas movie is this?
Yes, yeah. But yeah, they're all, you know, they're
some of them survive.
Yeah.
like to emphasize.
Yeah. Some of them survive. I'm not going to tell you which ones. You haven't watched the film.
Right,
I'm not going to tell you which
fair
ones.
Enough.
But again, you know, this is one of those films that's a little bit outside of that norm because not many of them act like victims.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, again, it's one of those things that makes it just that little bit scarier because there are no rules. It's not like, oh, as long as I don't do this, I'll survive the horror film. There are characters in this film who...
This is one of the prototype slasher movies, so it's those rules hadn't set in. So Bob Clark, you know, started a trend, and I think there's probably a couple of different possible... candidates for where slasher movies started from, but you know, Black Christmas is one of them, and yeah, it's 74, so it was unusual that not only are all the majority of the characters female, but you know, their survival, whether they survive or not, is almost entirely dependent on them.
I just wish you hadn't spoiled it by saying that people die.
A few of them. I mean, you know. Also, just a quick shout out to Bob Clark and his actual Christmas movie, A Christmas Story.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I feel at this point it's safe to say it's not going to be on any of our list. I don't know.
No. Well, you know, I actually thought about it. Because I figured you were going to do Black Christmas, and I figured someone should counterbalance that with Bob Clark's other Christmas movie. It is weird that he's done these two Christmas movies on the opposite end.
That's actually crazy.
Yeah, on the opposite end of the spectrum where you have this heartwarming family comedy and then this like pitch black, like death is coming for you on swift winds kind of deal. It's...
He's got a lot of
the man's got
opinions.
Range.
Yeah, he's got a lot of angles on Christmas. Yeah,
potentially Christmas he has covered. Some personal traumas around the holiday. I don't know.
Well, he made Christmas Story after Black Christmas, so maybe he worked them out and then was like embrace the holiday, like like somebody works retail for years and then is like sick of Christmas and then is like so. Yeah. Okay. Hey, what's your number two, Vince?
You made me speechless by mentioning retail, so now I'm terrified. So my number two, and I can already hear the voices of dissent on this one, but my number two is Martin McDonagh's In Bruges from 2008. And I think Christmas is mentioned maybe like three or four times, just kind of fleetingly throughout the film. But I would argue that there are a lot of like the themes of the movie are kind of Christmas movie themes in some way, if you look hard enough, I guess. I mean, it's two guys. It's Colin Farrell and it's, now I forget his
Brendan
name.
Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson, yeah. Okay, as two hitmen hiding out in Bruges.
Donald's dad.
After a murder has gone wrong or an assassination, whatever. And they're sort of, like they're reflecting kind of on the morality of what they do. And so I would argue there are some kind of Christmas theme conversations, I guess, in the film. And I think just the general imagery of Bruges as this ancient kind of light snowfall on this ancient kind of cobblestone-lined town or village. Just evokes this image of Christmas, I would argue. So, again, like another unorthodox one, but I would...
I love In Bruges. I've never thought of it as a Christmas movie, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nor did I, again, yeah.
Until you were given a challenge, self-challenge.
Exactly, yes.
Of course, we have, worth noting, we have three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri in theaters now, and it will be... our review next week. Tim Phillips and I are going to do that. So tease for that.
I hear it's great.
I did see it at TIFF, and it is great. Yeah,
excellent.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah, that was one of the movies I saw at TIFF.
Actually. Okay, okay, good. got caught off track. On that note, let's do number ones. Candace, why don't you give us your number one?
Sure. I have saved the schmaltziest for the last, and it's A Wonderful Life. So Jimmy Stewart is just my favorite ever, all everything. But what's interesting is that I had never even seen this movie until about 1990. I remember we bought my grandmother a VCR for Christmas and a couple of VHS tapes. Of course,
ask your parents about VCRs.
She opened the VHS.
We don't have time to go through it on this episode.
So she was opening the smaller gifts first, so she opened a VHS tape of It's a Wonderful Life and was confused because she didn't really know, like, she didn't have a VCR and what is this, but it's also one of her favorite films. And so mm-hmm. she was sort of excited and confused at the same time. And then she opened the VCR. But so that year at Christmas was the first year that I had seen this film. We watched it. It was Christmas Day. And the first thing we did was put up, you know, put the VCR in and start playing it. And I just immediately fell in love with Jimmy Stewart. And the film is just, you know, and it's interesting, of course, because everybody talks about it as a Christmas movie. But really, mm-hmm. there's only a short... very short amount of it that actually happens at Christmas. It begins because it's Jimmy Stewart's character, of course, and Clarence is watching, and all of the climax of his life and his decision is around Christmas. But it's really just the story of you know, one person's life and all of the different choices that lead you to a place that isn't necessarily the place you set out to be to begin with, but is still the right place because you made these choices.
Mm-hmm.
And just coming to terms with that, I think it's something that we all have to do at certain points in our life where we go, you know, I could have done that, but I didn't. And that's okay, because look at all these other great, amazing things that I did do and that I that you know, have out of life. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'm just a big fan of the Charleston too. I mean, I think every Charleston contest should end with everybody in the pool.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's a great scene. It's so funny. And I feel like some of the magic of that scene is lost because it's something, you know, how many sequences have we seen where something's happening around a pool and everyone ends up in the pool? Mm-hmm. And we may get to that in a minute when I do my number one. I was just looking up the release date of It's a Wonderful Life, and it came out at Christmas.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if that is somehow
connected to it really as well. Is a Christmas movie. Like,
well, yeah,
it's Christmas.
I'm not disputing
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to note, because one of the things I discovered about Miracle on 34th Street, it came out in June.
What?
Yeah, it came out in June, and it was because David L. Zelnick thought that more people go to the movies in the summer. So
oh,
he wanted
not wrong
to.
On that, I think.
So yeah, so you know, he was a very early adapter to the blockbuster mentality.
That's like really early. That's yeah. like 1934 or
he
something.
He was creating the blockbuster.
Yeah, so he was ahead of his time. But yeah, so I was curious about that. I just wanted to look it up. It opened wider in January, but it did mm-hmm. open in New York and LA mm-hmm. before Christmas. Repeating again, speaking of early adapting, that's what a lot of sort of yeah. prestige movies do yeah. these days.
So and just coming back to the In Bruges thing, I think similar to In Bruges, when people think about Christmas, they think about that small town with the boulevard, you know, and the snowfall, and that's of course when the scene when he's running through and loving everyone, oh my god, and everybody's great. But that's a very, you know, when people think about the quintessential Christmas scene of a town, it's that kind of look.
And they did reshoot It's a Wonderful Life get rid of the storyline where Jimmy Stewart was depressed because he shot the wrong person while doing a hit.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, there was that.
I heard something about that, yeah.
Those are the extra scenes on the special edition DVD.
Let's be honest, that just would have made it too depressing, I think. It's yeah.
There's that Simpsons gag too where the guy has the deleted ending of Casablanca, and he also has the Killing Spree ending for It's a Wonderful Life. now that we've punctured holes in that one, Vince, give us your number one.
Well, I'm also doing a schmaltzy pick as well.
What?
Yeah, after an entire episode of very unorthodox movies, I am actually also picking It's a Wonderful Life as well. And I am really
not see that coming.
Yeah, I was not prepared.
That was so on point.
I've trolled you the
entire
episode.
The Kaiser Sose of end credits.
I know. I'm about to walk out of the studio with a limp. I saw this movie for the first time like very late as well. I actually went through film school without having seen this movie, and I like would not admit it to anybody. I was so ashamed. And then I finally sat down and watched it, and again, it's hard to like not know what you're in for because it has this reputation as this feel good kind of inspirational movie. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was getting it into something a little bit sappy, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it also earns that sappiness through some very kind of not very, but some darker moments as well, which is how I think the movie has the reputation that it does. But yeah, that's my number one. That is my favorite Christmas movie of all time. Quote unquote Christmas movie.
Right. The Christmas movie. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, that was 47, so Capra made that right after coming back from the war, so.
Yeah, and Spielberg says he watches two movies before he makes a movie. It's a Wonderful Life and Citizen Kane, so.
Yeah. I think he also does Lawrence of Arabia, or he interchanges it.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, either way, I mean, Capra, of course.
That was tied for my number one. Lawrence of Arabia just got beaten out.
Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. 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 Oh, wow.
So now we've come full circle.
My number one is also a classic. It is also from that era. It is A Christmas Carol, or Scrooge, to use its original title, from 1951, the Brian Desmond Hurst version starring Alistair Sim. I like this version the best because I think it gets to what I think Dickens was getting at, which is it's a horror story. It's a tale of, you know, peril for your immortal soul, that, you know, you make your life about, you know, being a jerk and being a miser and treating your fellow man like crap, that you're going to pay for it in the next life. And I think one of the reasons I find It's a Wonderful Life as a pick for you two is interesting, and Christmas Carol for me, is because, you know, these are kind of ideas that have been kind of, I don't want to say bastardized, but I will. But, you know, they've kind of been recycled, and they're kind of, you know, kind of silly. They've been sort of, you know, done again and again. And, you know, A Christmas Carol is something that's been, like, the concept of A Wonderful Life, where it's like, I'm going to see what life was like without me. That there's usually some kind of It's a Wonderful Life episode in a lot of shows.
Every show.
And, you know, the Christmas Carol, too. I mean, they've done, like, an Old West version of A Christmas Carol. They've done, like, the female Ebenezer Scrooge version. And they've done, like, the Chicago 1920s gangster version. There's probably one out there somewhere. But, you know, it's very often not played very straight. And it's not straight like this. And there are, like, three straight-out horror scenes in it. In the Hearst version. And one is the lament after Marley visits Scrooge, and it shows other apparitions who are also similarly chained like Marley, sort of taunting these people outside Scrooge's home. There's the scene where the ghost of Christmas Present reveals to Scrooge the children, the personifications of want and ignorance, telling them to be careful of want, but especially be careful of ignorance. And then the ghost taunts him with his famous line, "Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?" And of course, the whole sequence with the ghost of Christmas Future, and the reveal that all these people who are taking great joy in the death of this person that they're talking about is Ebenezer Scrooge. I mean, it's straight up horrific. And it's, you know, Alistair Sim sells it the whole way through. And one of the things I find remarkable about his performance, you can actually see the transformation. Mm-hmm. There's a very physical turn from when he's playing Scrooge before the ghostly visits, and when he's playing Scrooge after the ghostly visits, and it's really a remarkable performance and eminently quotable, and I think, like, the gold standard of I mean, this is the, you know, Olivier Hamlet version of A Christmas Carol, I think. You know, on top of it all, it does get the darkness right, and you know, I do think it's too gimmicky, a lot of the other versions. The only other version I can really think that is this dark, oddly enough, is Mickey's Christmas Carol. Because there's, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but in the future sequence, he takes Scrooge to the cemetery. First of all, you see Mickey Mouse, who plays Bob Cratchit, you see him, like, crying at the grave of Tiny Tim. And that's, like, traumatic enough. But then the ghost of Christmas Future takes Scrooge, played by Scrooge McDuck, to his grave. And at one point, the ghost takes down his hood, and it's Pete. Like, Goofy's arch nemesis, right. Pete, and he's like, "It's your grave, Ebenezer, the richest man in the cemetery." And he pushes Scrooge in, and the coffin at the bottom of the grave opens, and all this hellfire starts coming out, nipping at Scrooge's feet.
And it's so been you're a watching long time this. Since I've seen this, but now I'm intrigued.
But you got to picture this as a kid watching this, and you know, you like the Christmas Carol story, you like Mickey Mouse, and here you are, Pete is sending Scrooge McDuck to hell.
Yeah.
And although you know it's like a dream sequence because that's the story, it's still kind
of... In the context of you as a kid, yeah. It's disturbing. Yeah. Yeah.
Pete
yeah.
is sending Scrooge McDuck back to hell. So yeah. I think between that and the Hearst version, I think those are the two essential versions in terms of just like finding that, like it really selling the message that there was a consequence to Scrooge not changing and really visualizing that. And I think it makes the story all the more redemptive rather than just mm-hmm. like, hey, we're ghosts and we're going to teach you a lesson. Like it's an after school special. But anyway.
Yeah. But you know what? I think what I like about the two sort of top picks that we have basically is that it doesn't really matter how miserly or how much you give and give and give. In reality, it's just about the relationships, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I think I like about just to get a little about this holiday mm-hmm. season in general, right? People will go on and on about whether it's, you know, because there's a number of different religions that all have holidays at this time of the year. And then there's all the gift giving and all the this and all of that and the stress. And it's just a good reminder for us all that it's just like, it's just about the people you know, the people you care about. That's in the end, all the money in the world or giving everything. None of that matters.
I love how we started out trying to like overcome the themes and everything and like try to outsmart the process with our lists, and then we've come together in this very traditional schmaltzy Christmassy message, and that's where we're gonna leave it. So thanks, guys. Thanks for coming in today to do our Christmas list. And I think this will be imminently replayable over the holidays if the CFRU staff wish it. That's a plug, by the way. And this is a plug. End Credits, you can find us on endcreditsradioshow.com, on social media, on Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and End Credits Radio on the Twitter. Vince, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm just going to stop saying Twitter, so I'm just going to say Facebook. Vince Masson. Haven't quite figured out the Twitter thing, just based on your look.
Well, now you know what to do for Christmas.
Confused.
Candace?
You can find me all over the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. And please listen to The Village Podcast, which is the show I co-host and produce for The Bookshelf Downtown Guelph.
And speaking of other shows, you can find me later today on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. That's at 5 p.m. on the Thursday. And then I am on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more End Credits. See you then.